Welcome to Spotlight, a weekly event where we interview one of our members and learn a little or a lot about their life. This week, I am delighted to have the opportunity to interview Steve Pallett, or who we often refer to as the King of England. How you doing, Steve?
Hello, Jen, and hi, everybody. I'm doing absolutely fine. And just to let you know, I've got the crown on. It's a bit uncomfortable, but you'd have to do these things, don't you, when it's official?
Just part of your civic duty. I enjoyed the pre-interview I did with Steve tremendously. Found out a few fascinating things about Steve I hadn't known before. And now it's time to reveal these interesting tidbits to the rest of you. Steve, let's start by talking about your childhood. Were you born blind? And about your other disability. Let me see if I can get it right now. Osteogenesis imperfecta, or OI. If you would tell us about your very early childhood, that's a great starting place.
Yes, okay. Well, I was born in December 1951. I was born around about 2.5 miles away from where I'm sitting at the moment, in a little village. So I haven't moved very far away from home, apart from schools for the blind. But as I say, I was born in December 51, born at home, and apparently as soon as I was born, my mother realised that I couldn't see. It was pretty obvious because my eyes were not normal, and it was pretty obvious that, you know, I was a blind baby. Although the medical profession sort of tried to fob her off and say, well, maybe he will be able to see a little bit. But by the time I was 9 months old and I went to ophthalmic surgeons, etc., in the local big hospital, it was pretty obvious that I hadn't got any sight. And I'm not sure what they do these days, but back in the early 50s, they were pretty brutal to parents of blind children, and this ophthalmic surgeon just sort of said, oh well, he's blind and he'll never see, he'll have to go away to school, but it won't be too awful, you know, and that was it. And of course my parents were sort of, they knew that that's what was going to happen, but it was a very, very brutal way of actually telling them, you know. And I know my mum to this day is still upset and angry about the way they were actually told. So that was that, and I apparently had a pretty normal childhood from what I can gather until the age of 2. And on Christmas Eve 1953, although I can't remember it, I was 2 years and 3 weeks old. A relative came to visit, and like most toddlers, I wanted to sit on his lap, and I sat on his lap, and eventually I began to wriggle around a little bit like children do, indicating that I wanted to go on the floor, and he just put me on my feet, stood me up like you would a toddler, and I immediately just fell over, and the upshot of that is that I broke my leg in two places. I broke my left leg above and below the knee. I was taken to hospital, obviously, and nothing much was made of this. They just thought it was one of those strange things, and I was put in a plaster cast and left there for a few weeks in plaster. And when they took it off, everybody expected me to just, you know, recover, but apparently I was reluctant to walk. I just wouldn't do it. I can't remember, of course, I was far too young. But I can't remember, but apparently I didn't want to walk, and they began to wonder why. And a little while later, it was pretty obvious what was the matter, because I fractured again, and I eventually got a diagnosis of osteogenesis imperfecta, which is a genetic bone condition, which means that the bones are brittle, and they take far, far longer to heal after fracture than normal bones, and they do break easily. So from the age of 2, that's when they discovered, well, 3, I was about 3 when they actually discovered what I'd actually got, Jen.
That was a pretty tough entrance into the world, Steve, and I'm sure it's impacted your life in very, very major ways. What happens now? We've got this little boy, and he's blind, and he's got OI. What happens when school time rolls around, Steve?
Well, when I had a pretty protected childhood, as you could imagine, I couldn't really go out and play with the other kids because I ended up, fracturing. So I had a pretty sheltered childhood, really, and I've got a great debt of gratitude to owe to my uncle and auntie who lived just across the road from us. My mum's brother lived just across the road, and they used to take me out with them, used to take me around, take me everywhere. Mum and Dad didn't drive, so I used to be taken out by my auntie and uncle. And one or two funny incidents occurred that I can actually remember from an early childhood. When I was about four, I remember on one occasion we were out in my uncle's car, and he was unwise, shall we say, unwise enough to let me sit in the driver's seat while he was in the back of the car with my auntie. I was pretending to drive the car, but I took it just one little step too far, and I actually let off the handbrake, and the car started to roll, and I've never seen anyone move so fast in all my life. He was out of that door and grabbed the driver's door and managed to stop the car. But that was my childhood memory of that. And you know, they used to take me on holiday with them and things like that. They were very, very good to me. I owe a lot to them. But when it came around to school, because of my brittle bone condition, they wouldn't risk sending me away to school for the blind for a start. They thought it was too hazardous. So my first introduction to education was by someone called a home teacher. They were sort of like social workers for the blind who actually were able to teach a little bit as well. And she was a blind lady herself. Little bit daunting, little bit scary in a way, because she was very, very tall. She was well over 6 feet tall, and for a lady, she was very, very tall and kind, but you know, a little bit daunting. And she used to come and teach me at home and taught me the rudiments of Braille and taught me to use a Taylor frame, which I'm sure some of you would remember, to do arithmetic on. It was a metal frame with holes in, star-shaped holes, and you used to use metal type to fit into the holes, and the type had tactile markings on, and as you rotated the type in the hole, of course the angle of the tactile marking changed, and it meant different things for the different numbers. I'm sure many of you have probably seen them or heard of them. They're superseded now, of course, but she taught me the basics of that, and that's how my education began.
Wonderful story about your driving lesson there, Steve. And how old were you when you actually first started to read?
Well, that's a difficult question, really, because although she taught me the rudiments of Braille, I was probably five, six, something like that, when I very first started. But then they decided then that I should attend a school for the blind, and I went to a school for the blind about 80 miles away from where I lived, up near the English Welsh border, in a little border town not far from the Welsh border, about 80 miles away. And to be quite honest with you, I absolutely hated it. I loathed and detested every minute of it, because I had to go to school for blind kids with additional disabilities. They wouldn't risk sending me to school just for blind people, because they thought I wouldn't survive, and I probably wouldn't. But I actually went to school for blind kids with additional disabilities, and those additional disabilities could be absolutely anything. It could be learning difficulties, people with emotional problems, people with other physical disabilities, and, you know, some of the kids were, through no fault of their own, obviously, they were violent, they were disruptive, they were very hard to deal with, and I just hated it, as you can imagine, after being at home. I was about 7 by the time I got there, and a little bit older, and maybe, I wouldn't say I could understand why I had to go, but, you know, I was aware that I'd been taken there, and as I say, I absolutely hated it.
And very understandably so, here's this little boy who'd been home up to age of 7, and now you're plunked down at the school in the midst of children who you really couldn't consider your peers emotionally or maybe mentally as well. Were there any other children there that you could befriend? Or were you pretty much a stranger in a strange land, Steve?
There were one or two that I actually made friends with, yeah. One or two people who I could relate to, you know, and got friendly with. There were people there as well who were blind, but you know, they just happened to have other physical disabilities, who were very bright as well. It was a real mixture of people and abilities. So there were one or two people there that I could relate to, but I'm no longer in touch with any of them. I lost contact with them many, many years ago, those people.
So you're 7, and how long were you at this school, Steve?
It's hard to remember. I think it was approximately a year, about 12 months, I think. My memories are a little bit hazy. I think I've blocked a lot of it out, actually, to be quite honest with you. But I think around about a year. And then the OI kicked in again, and I fractured and one thing and another. And they decided it was a good idea to do some work on me in orthopaedic hospital. So I actually left that school and went into orthopaedic hospital near Birmingham, where they did a series of procedures on me to try and improve the shape of my leg, because this OI, your bones get distorted and go out of shape. So they decided it would be a worthwhile exercise to try and correct that. So I ended up in hospital for a fair length of time.
Oh, I guess I got a 3-part question here for you. So you're about 8, if you were there about a year before you went to the hospital. Would you say your education was benefited much during that year? And did you have schooling while you were in hospital? Was that your second break at age 8? And did you get to see and interact with your family much while you were in the hospital, while they were trying to correct the curvature of your legs?
I used to come home occasionally for weekends. I used to let the patients out. Sounds like a prison, doesn't it? But yeah, they used to let the patients out occasionally for weekends and things like that. Educationally, no, it stopped. It actually stopped. Now, I don't know why, because I was only a kid. I don't know why. I'd like to know why now. But no, the education didn't continue. And this procedure lasted for quite a long time. Well, after that, I really don't think they knew what to do with me educationally. But eventually, by the time I was nearly 10, I actually did go to another school for the blind, which was the next school up from the previous place, because it used to be like a feeder system. You know, you'd start at a young age at the first school for blind kids with additional disabilities, then you'd move on to the second school. And I went there, and I have a little bit better memories of that. It was a little bit better. I've grown up that little bit more, and you know, I understood a little bit better. But again, I was in contact with children who had got many, many problems, emotional and physical, plus being blind. So again, I was sort of like a fish out of water a little bit.
I'm also getting the picture, Steve, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we have this bright little boy. His education is basically being ignored. He's away at one horrendous school or another, or in a hospital. You must have been very lonely, very isolated, and I would think frustrated and bored a lot of that time, because there's so many things you would have been learning normally as a very bright little boy that you weren't exposed to. Were you happy to go to the second school? And how long were you there?
Yeah, I was sort of happy to go, because it wasn't all doom and gloom, you know. I mean, I'm making it sound terrible, but I mean, obviously there were bright moments and funny moments, and I have some happy memories of being there. In fact, I think I was friends with some of the staff more than the kids, you know, especially the people that actually looked after us, because remember, they were only probably young girls themselves. They were only about 18 or 19, and I was probably about 10. So they were like big sisters to me, really. And I remember some funny incidents. I'll tell you one in particular which stands out in my mind. After school, of course, there were many hours when you didn't know what to do with yourself after the school day had finished. And they used to arrange activities for us to do between after tea and bedtime, you know, between the evening meal and bedtime. And they used to have all these activities Monday to Friday, and you could choose what you wanted to do. And it was quite good, actually. And one of the activities was what they used to call boat club, you know, boat as in ship. And what that actually meant was that you could go upstairs into the big bathrooms, and there were big bathrooms at schools for the blind with big iron baths. And they used to fill the bath with water and used to let the kids play around with boats and things, not actually in the bath, but, you know, standing next to it. And it was quite good fun, you know. And one member of staff in particular, I used to like a lot, and we got on very well. She was actually sitting at the end of the bath. She just perched on the end of the bath, and she was teasing me. She was saying something to me, I can't remember what, but she was having a joke with me and teasing me a bit. And I just touched her on the shoulder, and I just gave her a little tiny, tiny push, and of course she overbalanced and went backwards, and she fell straight into this bath full of freezing cold water. And I thought, Steve, you've really done it this time. But after she, you know, got her breath back and come up for air, and she just laughed and laughed and laughed and just ran out and had to get completely changed. But I do remember that.
Yeah, that does sound like a great memory. Well, how long were you at the second school where you attempted to drown the staff, Steve?
Oh, that was a couple of years, and then by the time I was 12, I progressed to the third school in the chain. Again, very, very similar. But this time I was a little bit more fortunate. There were a couple of people there who really took an interest in what, you know, my future, if you like. And there's a particular lady, she's still alive now, she's well into her 80s, but she was a teacher, a blind teacher, and she used to teach Braille. And I was a pretty good reader by now, you know, I could read pretty well. And behind the scenes, they must have got together with my parents, and they decided that really it wasn't the place for me. And they took a big risk, although I didn't appreciate at the time what a big risk it was. By the time I was 14, the wheels had turned, and they decided that, okay, I'd progressed enough in my physical ability. I forgot to add that I've been wearing leg braces and what we call calipers over here ever since I was about 4 years old, so I've got leg braces on, which I still have now to this day. And all sorts of, you know, things like that to help me walk. But they decided behind the scenes that I really ought to try and get into a school for the blind, just for blind kids. And there was one about 40 miles away from where I live currently. on the outskirts of Birmingham, which I'm sure a lot of you have heard of. It's a big city over here. And they decided to take me on a trial period just to see how I coped. And I went for 10 days, and it was really scary, because suddenly I'd gone from a relatively protected environment where most of the kids couldn't, you know, put one foot in front of the other, so to speak, like myself, to a place where the kids were crazy. I thought they were crazy. You know, they were just normal blind kids, and they were running around, jumping up and down, you know, steps and stuff like that, flying around on bikes, and I thought, oh boy, well, what's happened? It was huge complex as well, and I thought, oh boy, you know, can I handle this? And I went for 10 days, and then went back to the other school, and they must have got together and scratched their heads and said, oh, okay, what do you think? And they obviously thought, okay, we'll give it a go. So I went to that school, and that's really where my education began, and I had to learn a lot in a short period, as you can imagine.
Oh, I can't imagine you had so much catching up to do. Well, before we talk much about these school days, you were 14 now. When the 10 days was up and you were told that they would accept you back, were you happy about that? And now, at age 14, how many fractures have you experienced by this time?
That's a good question. I don't know, 30, 40 perhaps? Yeah, something like that, I should think. I was happy. I was happy to be going back, because in that 10-day period, I met a friend who I think will be a friend until the day either, you know, I die or he dies. And that's a friend called Keith who lives in Derby, which is about 18 miles away from where I live now. And we immediately struck up a rapport when I went for the 10-day interview. He's a little bit younger than me. He was only 11 at the time, nearly 12, and I was 14. And I think they'd been given a bit of a talking to by the headmaster. I mean, he told me years later that they actually said, now, look, we've got this kid coming for 10 days and he's very fragile and you can't, you know, be very careful, don't crash into him if you can avoid it or anything, you know. And we became firm friends, and for some reason he literally did take me under his wing, and for the rest of my time there, he actually made sure I was okay all of the time, you know, literally. Made sure I got from A to B safely, and it was marvellous, really. I mean, nobody told him to. Why a kid of 12 should, you know, bother, I've no idea, but thank God he did. And I honestly think without him, I wouldn't have survived, because I did have one or two mishaps, as you can imagine, while I was there, but not nearly as many as I would have had without his help.
Well, he does sound like a true friend, and like the two of you are kindred spirits. Would you say that this stage of your life, 14, and this school for the blind, was a happy period in your time, maybe one of the happiest, or the happiest so far in your childhood?
Oh yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. We got to know, I met some really, really good friends, and we used to roar with laughter and mess around just like kids do. We used to be music mad. We used to play records, tapes, you know, plus the education, of course, but that came secondary, didn't it? You know what kids are like. No, I'm only joking. I really did enjoy my time there. And of course, if I hadn't gone there, I wouldn't have met Sue, and I probably wouldn't be here sitting talking to you. I met Sue at school. I remember her before she remembers me. She was 12 when I first had any recollection of her, and I was about 14. I'd just gone there. But yeah, indeed. So I've got a lot to thank that school for.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about your school year courtship. I really enjoyed that part of your story the other day when we talked.
Okay, well, back at the previous schools, one thing they did put a lot of emphasis on was music. I suppose it's because it's something that a lot of the kids could relate to and participate in a little bit, you know. And I learned to play the recorder. I'm sure you all know what a recorder is. It's like a baroque instrument. It's an insult to call it a whistle, but you know, I'm sure you know what I mean. A recorder. It's a sort of like a baroque type instrument, a bit like a flute sounding thing. And I learned to play this, and I got reasonably good. I was, you know, pretty good at it, although I say it myself, not too bad anyway. And when I went to the last school where I met Sue, they used to have a recorder group, and for ages they kept saying, why don't you join the recorder group? And I kept saying, no, I've had enough, you know, not interested, don't want to play anymore, been there, got the t-shirt, done all that, don't want to do it, not interested. Well, eventually I thought, oh, okay, I'll give it a go. And one of the members of that group was a girl called Susan Rowe, who I thought, hello, you're nice, you know, as I say, I remember her from when she was 12. She's about 13 by then, 14 perhaps. So I started to go to it, and, you know, gradually we got to talk, and then we were very keen to sit next to each other every time we went to the recorder group, and well, there you go, that's how it all started, and we're here now, and we've been together ever since, really. She used to live about, what would it be, 13 miles from my home at the time, and after I'd left school, which I'll come to in a minute, she used to come over to spend the weekend at Mum and Dad's, and gradually we got closer and closer, and finally, you know, we married in 1976, but that's a long way down the line from where we are at the moment.
Okay, so you're at the new school and you finish your education there. I think something occurred again with your OI at the age of 18, and I'll let you tell us about that, Steve. Also, any other highlights of the four years or so that you spent at blank school, if you'll talk to us about that now.
Yes, certainly. I had a I really enjoyed that school. Of course, I was in my teens then, and they were pretty strict, but fair, you know, and we used to have a good time. And as you say, unfortunately, I did fracture again. I had a nasty accident and broke my leg. I only slipped. I mean, most people would have just got up again, but not me. I just fell on my bottom, and that was it. And ended up in yet again in hospital. And then they couldn't really handle me at school, so I went home for a good few months, about 6-7 months. And then I went back again. And then they allowed me to continue at school a little bit longer than I would have been, you know, the age I should have been when I left, but they allowed me to carry on. And we had a really good time. I really, you know, quite enjoyed it. But fate dealt another blow, and just before I was due to leave, I fell again, and guess what? Yeah, that's right, broke my leg again. Ended up in hospital, in the local hospital to the school, and it was just before we were due to take our final exams, so you know before we left. So I went back to school, had to go into their, you know, sick bay, or I don't know what you'd call it in America, but the place where you go in boarding school when you're not well, you know. And they had to be in there, and they allowed me to take the final exams there. But no one was allowed to speak to me, no one was allowed to see me. I couldn't have any visitors on the day of the exam, for obvious reasons, because they didn't want me to get any prior warning as to what the questions were or anything about it. And I did the exams on my own, with a teacher popping in every 5 minutes to see I was okay, but basically on my own. And a few days after that, I went home in plaster, and that was it. I actually left that school with a broken leg.
Well, what do you think the next, what do you consider the next major event in your life, Steve?
Oh, the next major event, really, I suppose, was after I'd healed. As I said to you, it takes the fractures a long time to heal. They decided that maybe I could do telephony, and they sent me for an assessment to the Telephony College in London. It was in London in those days, but it isn't now. But again, they just wouldn't take the risk. They just would not take the risk of having me there with my, you know, problem. So I came home and very despondent, very depressed, really. And the next thing that happened really was there's a toy factory in the town where I now live. It's still the same town, and there used to be a toy factory. It used to make, well, you'd know him as G.I. Joe. You'd know him as that, but over here it was called Action Man. It's a doll, a figurine. They used to make all sorts of toys, and my some of my relatives used to work there, and they put a few feelers out, and they actually decided that they would, okay, they wouldn't let me go to the factory, but, you know, they would let me do some homework. So, you know, that's what I ended up doing. And so for a couple of years, it was really mind-numbingly boring. I sorted parts for toys. I used to have a huge consignment delivered, a sack. You used to have about 5,000 pieces in it, and the job was to sort them out. Hands, feet, arms, legs, knees, elbows, you name it. Sort them out for assembly. So that was really boring, wasn't it? But eventually the factory closed down, and again, fate played its part. And guess what? Yep, another fracture. And then they decided that they would do some extensive work on my legs, and so back into hospital again for long, long periods to have surgery. And that basically stretched from 73 up until about 1978.
So you're about 21, 22 now, I guess. I'm curious, backing up a moment, about the toy factory. Was this a place where other blind people were working, or were you just so desperate to have employment and to be doing something that you contacted them? Or were there other blind people working at this factory?
Oh, no, no. I was the only one. And they, you know, they're very good at promising you things, aren't they? They're very good at promising you. Obviously, we did have some officers over here whose job it was to actually find employment for disabled people. But as now, the employment situation is desperate for disabled people over here in the UK. I'm not sure what the percentage is, but it's very, very high of people who are unemployed, you know. And they promised me that eventually they'd have me in the factory and stuff, but it never came. It never happened. And you know, as I say, fate took a hand, and that was the end of that. You know, after being in hospital, we, Sir and myself, decided that in 1973 we decided we'd get engaged. You know, it's pretty obvious that we were serious, and we decided to get engaged, and we did. You know, this is during this period, of course, of being in and out of hospital. And we waited until 1976, and we finally decided that we'd get married. Because, you know, if you're waiting for things to be perfect, they never are perfect. There's never the right moment to do these major things. So if you waited for everything to be perfect, you'd wait forever. So we sort of said, okay. And I said to Sue, are you sure you know what you're taking on, because goodness knows what's going to happen in the future, you know. And she said, yeah, that's no problem. So we married in July 76. And I even got married in plaster, would you believe? On my wedding photograph, I've got my toes poking out.
You're so chic there, Steve. Well, I know, I'm assuming your folks thought a lot of Sue. She spent a lot of time at their home on weekends and whatnot. I guess you two couldn't court like a typical couple because of your OI. And so were your folks very supportive of your marriage? And after you married, where did you two start housekeeping?
Yes and no. My family were very good because they knew Sue. I mean, she'd been coming over for years by that time, you know, for probably 6 years by then. So they knew Sue pretty well, and they were pretty good, well, very, very good. Unfortunately, my dad, he died just a month before we were married. He died of cancer, and it was a big shock, obviously. We knew he was ill, but he died in the June, and we got married in the July. So he never actually did see us marry, which is, you know, very sad for us, really. But certain members of family were opposed. Certain members on Sue's side of the family were opposed to it, and were pretty anti, which I suppose, looking back, I can sort of understand, you know. But we were determined, and we went ahead with it. And shortly afterwards, we got the chance of a little bungalow. We were really, really thrilled. We married in the July, and in the October, we got a chance of moving into a little bungalow, a rented one. But it was great, lovely little place. And within 3 months, we'd set up, and you know, it was fantastic. And he's still fantastic now, although it's not the same bungalow. But yeah, we set up home, and you know, and everything fell into place. And then from then on, things really began to look up.
It sounds like it was wonderful for both of you, and knowing both of you, I'd have to say you're both very lucky people. What was Sue doing during this time? Was Sue working?
No, Sue was working up until the time we were married. She went to secretarial college. She's blind as well, by the way. I'm sure everybody knows that, but it's pretty obvious that if I met her at school for the blind, she's got to be blind as well. She was working as secretary for social services, a social services department in the next county where she lived. But she gave up work really to make sure I was okay, because obviously I'm not at all good on my feet, as you can imagine. And so she gave up work to basically to make sure I was okay. And then, you know, things moved along quite nicely. I'll skip past the fractures in 1978, which put me back in hospital again. And then we met Mr. Cox, Bill Cox, who we featured last week. And I met Bill through a mutual friend. I'd been told by this mutual friend that why don't you subscribe to this tape magazine that my friends set up. And I thought, oh, okay, you know, sounds like a good idea. And I did. And then I spoke to Bill on amateur radio, because we're both amateur radio operators, and I didn't really know Bill at all well in those days, but I knew who he was. And we got friendly, and I don't know why, but Bill thought it would probably be a good idea to come and see us and interview us about ourselves, you know. And he did. He came and he spent a couple of days with us, and we became firm friends, and we've been friends ever since. Well, a little while after that, he thought it would be a good idea if I helped him with the magazine. And he asked me, and I said, yeah, fine, I'd love to do it. Because I've always, like a lot of blind kids, I've always been interested in recording and tapes and record players and you name it, you know. So he set me up with mixers and cassette machines and amplifiers and microphones and microphone stands and stuff like that. And we began to do features for him. But we began to work for the magazine. And it was quite an interesting and enjoyable thing to do. We used to get all the people from the IT firms in to show us the latest products. You know, I remember seeing JAWS in its infancy and VersaBrowse and things like that, you know. And we used to interview all these people. They used to come along and set up all the equipment. And I used to interview them and get to know all about it. And things like that. And then Bill also would be feeding me with features that he'd recorded from his end. And then the job was to time all the features, make sure they were running okay, edit them, mix them down, make up a master cassette, and send it along to Bill. And Sue used to do the continuity announcing, like the links between the items. You know, she was an anchor woman, if you like. And that's how we did it, and we did it for several years, and used to really enjoy it. Bill used to go and interview people, and I used to go and interview people, or they used to come to me, and that's how we did the National Tape Magazine for the Blind. In fact, my proudest thing really is to be involved with when Bill went to interview one of our big stars over here called Cliff Richard. He's not well known in the States, but he's mega over here and has been for many, many years. He's like, I suppose he's an equivalent to, I don't know, one of your very, very famous pop stars. Not exactly Elvis Presley, but not far off it. And Bill had the pleasure to interview Cliff at a theatre, and he did an hour and a half interview with Cliff Richard, and I actually edited the program and mixed in music, and that was the one I really enjoyed doing. So that was a great thrill, and we interviewed all sorts of people. So we had a really, really good time helping Bill when we were working for the Tape Magazine.
It sounds like it would have been loads of fun, and I know Cliff Richard. Speaking of music, we're going to be playing one of your tunes, the one that landed on the Peeps album, Steve, in a little bit. And we know you played the recorder in school. When did you get interested in keyboards and I think drums as well?
Oh, that's a difficult question. Always been interested in them. You know, back in those days, when I was a kid, I don't know about in America, but most people used to have a piano in the house, you know. We used to have one battered up old thing it was, and my grandma, who lived only next door to us, she used to have one, and I was forever messing around with it, and, you know, playing around with the piano a little bit. And I've always been interested in percussion. I've always been mad on drums, and, you know, anything I could hit made a noise. That was me. And I remember having a toy drum kit when I was a kid, and it must have driven the neighbours crazy, but they didn't mind. Well, I don't think they did anyway. Well, they didn't hit me anyway. I put it that way. So always, Jen. But I never really took it seriously until many, many years later. When I was at the last school, I had piano lessons a little bit, but I didn't really get on very well because they didn't want to teach me what I wanted to play. I wanted to play pop stuff and things like that, and they didn't want me to. And so, you know, it didn't really work out too well. But years later, I had the opportunity to pick up the piano again, or take up the piano again. Picking it up would have been a bit of a difficult job with the weight of a piano, but many, many years later I had the opportunity to start again, and I did, and I still play now a little bit. I'm not very good. My memory lets me down. I really admire these people who can remember pieces, but I can't. I just can't hold them in my head. I've tried, but it just will not stay. So, you know, I enjoy what I do, but I'm not that good at it, unfortunately.
Well, this might be a good time to see if Parker's ready to play your Peep Shuffle. I love your music, and I've heard maybe 8 or so of your own compositions, and they have a fresh flavor all their own, Steve. We'll see if Parker's ready, and It'll give you a little break here, too.
Coming right up.
Wonderful tune, and of course I happen to be very partial to the name you chose for it, Steve. It's hard to sit still during that tune.
Yeah, well, I did that years and years ago, and I forgot all about it. I put it onto tape, and then when you were looking for things for the Pete's album, and you asked me, I just dug it out, and I thought, well, it hasn't got a title, so I came up with Pete Shuffle. So that's what it is, and I enjoyed playing that. So shall we move on to the next phase, because the next thing that actually happened during the time I was actually helping Bill with the magazine, I got involved with Leicester University and with their adult education department. I received a phone call one day from our local Society for the Blind. We have the Royal National Institute for the Blind over here, which is the main charity, of course, but most counties over here have a regional organisation for the blind, and they do similar work to the RNIB, but on a local scale. And I got a phone call one day from someone who said, Steve, would you mind going to Leicester University, because they're setting up a sculpture group for visually handicapped people. They want to do some research and see how it goes, you know. And I said, well, not really. It's not really my thing. I've never done anything like that. I'm not really into that sort of thing. So she said, oh, go on. You'd be doing me a big favour, because I can't get anybody to go. So I said, oh, okay, I'll go. So I went along to Leicester University and met a lady there called Rachel Sullivan, who was a sculptor and an artist, and spent the morning messing around, and I began to think, I quite like this, this is good. So she, at the end of the session, said, well, will you come back again the next time? So I said, okay, fair enough. And they arranged transport and everything, which of course is a major, major problem for all us blind people, and if you've got additional problems as well, it makes it even worse. But they laid on the transport, so it's about a 12-mile trip from where I am to Leicester. And I thought, oh, okay, fair enough. And I continued to go, and gradually, I thought, well, this is good, you know, I'm really enjoying this. And eventually, I really, really did get into it in a big way, and we progressed, and we began to use all sorts of different medium, clay and stone, etc., and learned how to carve, learned how to model, and learned how, you know, the different various techniques in sculpture work, and the different techniques employed And I did this for several years, and eventually they did a structured course and ended up with a diploma from Leicester University in sculpture, which, you know, for it's the visual arts, but obviously, you know, you use your hands a great deal in sculpture, and it's very, very tactile. So obviously, it's ideally suited for a blind person.
Well, Leicester University is what I was going to ask you about next, Steve. I think we've kind of glanced over your involvement with the magazine, because I think that was a wonderful pastime for you and a wonderful benefit to the blind. And it's a shame that that magazine came to a halt. You've done so many interesting things in your life that I guess we can't dwell on any one of them very long, though. I want to hear more about the sculpture. I also love to sculpt. And you told me in our pre-interview that many of these pieces that you did, and I believe so too, did go on tour. You sold some pieces. And how about telling us about one or two of your favorite pieces that you created?
Yes, I just go back a bit to the magazine. Yes, it was a very interesting thing to do, and really, really enjoyed it, and got the opportunity to meet lots of interesting people and see lots of interesting things, and it was a really enjoyable period. Yeah, the sculpture, yes indeed. Our exhibits, if you like, or our sculptures did actually go on tour alongside sighted sculptors. There was no indication whatsoever that they'd been done by a visually impaired sculptor or anything like that. We insisted on that. Well, we didn't have to insist on it because Rachel made it pretty clear that, you know, it had to stand alongside sighted people's work. So therefore there was no indication that it was done by blind people. And yeah, it toured the country, went all over the UK, and also went to Japan, because they take a great interest in this sort of thing in Japan, apparently. I didn't realise this, but apparently they do. And as I say, the exhibition toured, and it's been to all sorts of places. Some of the favourite things, we did a very interesting project on facial expression, because as a totally blind person from birth, it's something that I knew very little about, and we did a very interesting project on that, where we made masks in clay, illustrating different human emotions like fear, anger, surprise, horror, etc. And we had to be actually shown how the muscles of the face worked to create these various emotions, and that was very interesting. We also did self-portraits. We also did heads in clay, and they were very interesting to do as well. You had to feel the structure of your skull and every little nuance of your own head and your own face, and try and recreate it in clay. That was very interesting to do. And some of the other things, we did abstract things as well. One of my favourites was a big vessel I made, and it's about 24 inches high and about 24 inches across, and it's basically a huge bowl. I was peeling an orange one day, a little satsuma, and if you're very careful, you can actually take the peel off in one go, and I thought it would be interesting to try and recreate this in a sculptural form. So I did just that. I made the pot, and then I cut down vertically into it and peeled the pieces I'd cut back, when it was pliable, of course, because, you know, clay is very plastic when it's wet, and peeled it back, and tried to simulate this orange peel, if you like. So you've got a huge globe with a hollow centre, with cuts down it, and then the pieces pulled back, as if you'd taken a huge fruit out of its skin and just left the skin. We let it dry and fired it, and then we coloured it with different oxides. You use oxides when you're using clay. They're like a powder, and you mix them and apply them. And we did this with oxide, and before that I wanted the effect of an orange skin. You know, it's slightly rough textured and slightly, well, you know what an orange feels like. And I tried to simulate that, and I did that by, I actually grated the clay with a food grater, and then got lots and lots of slip, which is like a very wet solution of clay and water, mostly water, which bonds clay together. That's why it sticks together, and you can make things out of it. And we actually piled this stuff on, and then let it dry. And when it dried, it gave exactly the right feel, exactly the right effect I wanted. And then, as I say, we coloured it in oxides and fired it again, and it turned out, well, apparently visually quite spectacular. It's here now, it's here with me. So I think they are the most interesting things we did. But we've done all sorts of things. We did natural form, and we did all sorts of things, natural history topics, and blew them up huge scale. You know, plants and things, leaves and things like that, but on a gigantic scale, and we really blew them up, made them far bigger than life, you know. And it was a very interesting period, Jen.
Well, it surely is interesting hearing about it, Steve. Another quick question about the sculpture. We've been talking for about an hour, so can't dawdle as much as I would like on different topics here with you, Steve. You say that you used your oxides and did coloring before the second firing. Did you apply the color yourself? How much intervention did you have from Rachel or other people at Leicester with when it came to actual color?
I have to take advice on that, to be quite honest with you, because colour doesn't mean a thing. It's just words, you know, like most congenitally blind people or people who've been blind from birth. It's just words, so I really had to take advice on that side of it. But we discussed it, and she tried to give me as much information as she could, and I tried to understand as much as I could about how it worked and what the effect would be, because apparently with these oxides, they're not, when you apply them, they're not the colour they turn out to be when they're fired, because the actual firing process changes the colour. They're metals, basically, in powder form, and you know, when you apply them, they're one colour, but when they're fired, they change. So we had to try and work out the best combination for what we were trying to achieve. Before we finish, can I just say that one of the most proud things about the sculpture was that we had a purpose-built building eventually opened by called the Richard Attenborough Centre for Disability in the Arts, which is a purpose-built building. I'm sure you've heard of Richard Attenborough, the English actor. He agreed to be the patron of the art centre. And one of his friends just happened to be the Princess of Wales, and he kindly asked her if she'd actually open the new building, and she agreed, and she actually came to open the building, and we actually met her, which was quite exciting thing, spent quite a long time with her, talking to her and so on about our work, etc. And just a few weeks later, in fact about 11 weeks later, she died. So we met her in the May, and she died in the August, and you can imagine it was a big shock, because we spent quite a long time with her that day.
Yeah, that was a tragedy for many of us on this side of the pond too. She was a great humanitarian, but since you'd had the great fortune of meeting her, I'm sure, was a terrible blow. Well, Steve, so far we've learned about many interesting things, the magazine, the sculpture that you've dabbled in, your music, your survival of your OI, and now I guess it's time to talk about how you got into computers.
Oh, well, that's that goes back to about 1985 when Keith, you know, my friend from school, of course we'd all left school many, many years before, and he's married and got children of his own and so on. But as I say, we remain friends, and he sort of said that he was going to get a computer, a BBC computer. And he said, why don't you get one? So I said, oh, I don't know. He said, oh, go on, you know, I will if you will. So we said, okay, so we got the old BBC computers. They were only 32K, the whole memory, can you imagine? And we thought it was marvellous, and we bought a external speech synthesizer and stuff like that, and the software for the speech, I mean, in those days, was loaded off a floppy disk, off a 5-inch disk, and we played with that for several years, and eventually Keith decided to go on the internet, and he was fortunate really, because his stepfather taught computers at a technical college. He was well into computers, so therefore Ken knew a lot about computers, and he actually built Keith a machine. And Keith said to me, well, would you like Ken to build you one? So I said, oh, all right, and fair enough. So he built this machine and brought it over, Windows 95 on it. I'd never seen one before because all the other computers were in DOS and, you know, complete mystery. And I messed around with that for a little bit, and Keith taught me what he knew. And eventually we got on the internet, and then we started to surf the web a little bit and began to understand how it worked a little bit. And that's my introduction to computers, really. And one day I was on a website, I can't even remember which one now, and there was a reference to For the People. I think it might have been Your Blind Community. Is there a website called Your Blind Community or something like that? I'm sure it was that. It's just come to me. And I'm sure there was a link off there to For the People. And I thought, well, I wonder what it's all about. So I clicked on the link and found For the People. It's just about 2 years ago now, in a few weeks' time. And I thought, well, okay, I'll try and sign up for this. I'll try and do it. I'll try and get on. And it was in the days, Jen, when you hadn't got passwords and you hadn't got the security system you've got now. And I put a name in, because it said username or something like that. I can't remember what it said. But anyway, it said something, and I put something in. Coalman, I thought, well, I live in Coalville. And I put Coalman in there. And, of course, it was ages before Steve Shepherd's scripts were ever written, and you weren't even using the chatterbox then. And somehow, I must have got into the coffee shop. I didn't realise, of course, I'd no idea I'd actually done it. And the next thing, you were saying, hello, Coalman, and I nearly fell off my chair. You really made me jump. And that was my introduction to For the People, and Dennis was there. And, you know, I'm here, and I've been here ever since.
Yes, you certainly have. Well, Steve, it was a very short time that you became very involved in For the People, and over the last 2 years you've led several events, one being currently your dramatizations in the Playhouse, but you also talk about class here on site, and I understand you have done some volunteer work at home there in your own area too, with teaching Braille, so we can touch on that in a bit, and your enthusiasm, your dedication, and your concern for the site also led us to ask you to serve as one of the administrators for the site. And I want to thank you for all you've done thus far, and all I know you will continue to do for the site. I want to hear about your Braille, your volunteerism with Braille, and then we'll touch bases on what For the People has meant to you.
Yes, sure. Well, yes, indeed. A few years back, they put an advertisement in one of our Braille magazines for volunteers to teach Braille. Because in days gone by, it used to be social services' job to, you know, teach people Braille who'd gone blind, and I don't know how they used to manage, but I suppose they used to do a fair job. But gradually, with cutbacks, that went, and basically, there's no one really to teach newly blinded people Braille if they want to learn Braille. And they put an appeal to ask if any people would be willing to volunteer. So I rang the National Library for the Blind over here, which is a postal library, and said, yes, okay, you can put me on the list. I'm not an expert. I don't pretend to be an expert. In fact, if you gave me a test, you'd probably find I was pretty useless. But I can read. I can write. I've been doing it, you know, years and years. I'm a pretty good Braillist. And I thought, okay, I'll volunteer to be on the list of teachers. And nothing happened. But then one day I got a call from them, and they said that this lady wanted to learn Braille. And would you believe, she only lives 50 yards away, 100 yards away from me. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, this is strange. So she came round, and you know, we got the books, the tutorials that you use, and I taught her. And she picked it up really quickly. You know, she was a very, very quick learner. And within a couple of months, she was reading quite well. Whether she keeps it up now, I'm not sure, but, you know, she did. And, yeah, I taught her, and it was easy. Yeah, she was a good pupil. And then I thought, well, you know, maybe I could teach people on here. Not exactly the same as having someone actually physically next to you, but I thought, I'll give it a go. And I had one or two students on the peeps, and sent some stuff out to America, which I'd written, you know, it was reasonably successful, although my student who stayed the longest actually did give it up a little while ago, because I think she had family illnesses and stuff, but it did work, and I was really thrilled that I could teach someone to read Braille, or, you know, the beginnings of Braille, at a distance of about 11,000 miles, and it's quite a thrill.
It is fascinating. Of course, another one of the major contributions you make to the site, bar none, you are our interviewer supreme, and I guess all the work you did with the magazine gave you a lot of background and expertise with that, because you certainly do a bang-up job, Steve. Would you say that is one of the responsibilities or tasks that you take on for this site that you enjoy most?
Yeah, I do enjoy talking to people. I don't know about being the best interviewer. I think you've got some really good interviewers. it's very kind of you to say. You know, I think you all do a great job. But yeah, I do enjoy. I'm nosy, basically. That's what you have to be nosy, you see, Jen. That's what it is.
If that's the secret, I always feel a little intrusive. What has For the People meant to you? You told me a story about September 11th, 2000. And if you could share that with everyone, I think it's such a great synopsis of what For the People has come to mean to many of us.
Oh, yeah, I'll never forget that. Let me think. Yes, I was at home, of course, here in the lounge, in the living room. Sue had gone for a walk. Mum was with me. And it came on the radio about the awful things that happened in New York, you know, it was bad enough, but because I knew people, you know, and like to feel that I knew them well, but lived over there, like Angie and, you know, from the weekends, and one or two other people that I actually knew that lived not too far from where that must have taken place. I immediately thought, oh boy, how dreadful, and I had to, you know, come on here to just see that everybody was okay, that, you know, that you were all right, because that was my major concern. I thought, it's not just, it means more, because, you know, I could relate to it, and I remember Dan, who lives in New York. Apologies if you're in the room, Dan, and I'm getting this wrong, but I know you live very, very close to where it actually happened. And to be able to talk to people, and to be able to talk to Angie, who said, you know, that she could smell the smoke and things like that, and all the helicopters buzzing around, it really did bring it home. And I think we're one big family on here, you know, and we obviously do care about what happens to each other, and you can tell that, because every day we come and we come back again and again and again, and, you know, it is really something special.
That's true, and each of us in our own way makes that also. Steve, one of the things I asked you prior to our interview is, with your osteogenesis imperfecta and your blindness, which do you feel has impacted your life the most? Which has served as the larger obstacle? If you could discuss that a little now, if you don't mind.
Well, without a doubt, the OI has been a major problem. You know, I don't want to be gloomy, etc., but I did skip over the latest bunch of problems, you know, actually in 82, and spent lots of time in hospital then, and again in 89, and, you know, and just a few weeks back I thought I was in trouble again, because I did develop a problem, but that seems to have gone away now. But, you know, without the shadow of a doubt, yeah, the OI has been a major, major problem. I could have achieved a lot more, I think, but I just haven't been able to do it. I am bad on my feet. I'm very bad, and have to be very careful. And I think if I hadn't been as careful as I try to be, you know, I would have had a lot more problems. But 99% of the time, I just ignore it. It's just I nearly said a pain in the neck, but that would have been silly. But you know what I mean. I just ignore it most of the time. Don't think about it. But, you know, just once in a while, it just comes and reminds you that I'm still here. I can still give you a bit of a, you know, reminder from time to time. But I'm very happy, very happy-go-lucky, very laid back. I don't let things get on top of me too much. We live a great life. You know, Sue's inspirational. I don't know what I've done without her. She's listening on the other computer and probably going red now, but I've got to say it, you know. She's been an absolute wonderful person to be with for 27 years, and we're the best of friends. If you think I'm silly on here, you should hear us when I'm not on mic. I'm 10 times dafter then, and we just have a great time.
All right. I threatened you with telling everyone how poor Sue was sick on her birthday and received a tin of chocolate sardines, and you snarfed them down on her, took advantage of her illness. I had to blow the whistle on you, Steve.
Oh, Jen, you promised you wouldn't. Yeah, I'm afraid it's true. Well, not entirely true. She did have... It sounds horrible, doesn't it? Chocolate. There were chocolates in the shape of sardines, and they were a gift from a friend, and they were just like sardines, just about the right size, and the tin was exactly right, and, you know, the right shape and everything, but they just happened to be chocolate. Well, she'd got a bad cold at the time, and of course, you know, she couldn't taste it, so I couldn't see it go to waste, could I?
You're so noble. We'll just have to think of them as chocolate sculptures, Steve. We're running about an hour and 20 minutes now, and I do want to open the mic to folks with questions. You got a lot of your fan clubs on board here with us today. Becky is not here, but I do want to make sure I thank Becky for all the hard work she puts into coordinating Spotlight, and Dennis for recording and editing, and for everyone participating. And thank you very much, Steve. It's been a real pleasure getting to know you a little bit better. And again, I'll open the floor now for anyone with questions or comments for Steve.
Steve, when you was doing sculpture, did you do anything with molded clay?
Yes, sadly, the majority was with clay. We did stone as well, but yeah, the vast majority of it was clay work.
Goodbye, Uncle D. The old toy.
Steve, it's been a wonderful interview. No, I've been sitting here listening to you all the time. I take it really that the magazine must have from what you said about it, must have been a great boon to you in life. Do you think if the magazine did anything at all, that it got you to know people?
I'm sorry, Bill, I just missed the last little bit of your question there. Can you just ask me that again?
Bill Coyce.
Yeah, what I asked you was, if the magazine did anything at all...
My Bill Coyce.
Do you think it... do you think it got you...
I'm Parker in Missouri.
Sorry, Steve, it's difficult to talk over all this because I can't get rid of this bell. My computer's gone funny. But do you think it helped you... To have a greater understanding of people and the world in general. That's what I wanted to ask. When I say the world, perhaps that's a bit of an expansive question, but you did meet a lot of people and you did interview lots of people and you saw lots of equipment. I mean, was it a surprise to you at some of the time?
No, not really. It was good fun. I really enjoyed it. And yes, I did see things and met people I'd never have met and done things I'd never have done. Like, you know, when we went flying and things like that. Great opportunities. And the thing that impressed me really was the willingness of most people, 99% of people, to actually go along and do what you wanted them to do. Very, very rarely did I have a refusal or people saying, no, I'm not willing to do that. There's only one person, and that was a Christmas magazine we were doing, and we wanted some food prices, and I arranged to go to a supermarket here in town to get some food prices for Christmas, and he agreed to do it, and when I got there and set the tape recorder up, he changed his mind. It was a nightmare, and I just sort of, you know, smiled at him and said, you're not going to let me down, are you? You know, and he said, oh, well, all right, I'll do it for you. But, yeah, most people were very good, Bill, and I thank you for giving me the chance to actually be involved. It was a great period, and we had great fun, didn't we?
Yeah, we were delighted to have you anyway, and you did extremely well. Okay, Steve, thanks for answering that. Jennifer, it was a very nice interview. Thank you very much indeed for interviewing Steve. It's Beryl and I, we've been sitting here, and it's been very, very good to listen to, and he's quite a clever guy, really, isn't he?
He certainly is, Bill, and thank you for getting him so much training to be a wonderful Spotlight interviewer for us. Also, folks, if you click on Galaxy of Stars on the front page, then click on Presentation, you will hear a flying lesson that Steve took, and there's some motor noise and whatnot, of course, from the Cessna, but it's a fascinating interview, and if you haven't checked that out yet, be sure to do it.
Yeah, Steve, Jennifer, you did great. Steve, it was very interesting. I didn't know you were... You did sculpture. That's neat. Found out something new about you today.
Oh, well, there you go. Life's full of surprises, isn't it?
Yeah, Steve, a very good interview, and I was most enthralled and interested in the kind of thing that you had available back there in the 50s when you started schools and so forth, because, you know, I grew up in a slightly later era and in a different part of the United States, you know, but back then, in the state of Iowa, we had two schools, one for the blind and one for the deaf. And I didn't know, maybe it was available, but I didn't know about any of the other schools. Like you mentioned that there was one, I think the first couple that you went to, perhaps, where you were in a mixture of people with all sorts of emotional disturbance and so forth. And we just didn't have those back then, you know, at least not where I lived. And to this day, I think that the school that I originally started going to back in 1960 has now been completely turned over to just the what they call the underachievers, which is probably a school like you were discussing. But, you know, that was done, you know, a long time after I was there. And so, you know, I was interested to hear about that. And, you know, my hat's off to you, my man. You had a lot of things to work through, and you worked through them. And those are the kinds of people I admire.
Thanks very much, Mike. We had those schools for blind people with additional problems, shall we say. And then there were quite a few schools for, when I say just blind, I'm sure you know what I mean. Not disparaging in any way. The blindness is bad enough. But yes, we did have schools for the blind. And then there were a couple of schools for really bright blind people. We would call them the grammar schools. I don't know what you would call them over there, but the schools which fed people for university and things like that. There used to be one for boys and one for girls, and then they amalgamated probably in about 1980 into one school, and that still stands to this day. Whereas most of the schools for the blind closed down because now blind kids are educated in mainstream, so that's what happens now. But there still are a couple of schools for blind people with additional disabilities, and the ones I attended, one's been closed down and amalgamated with another, but as far as I'm aware, the second school still exists, but the school where I met Sue, the school where I finally ended up, closed down several years back because, you know, there were no blind kids, because they were all educated in mainstream.
Well, I want to say, Steve, that was the most wonderful lunch conversation I've experienced in a long time, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I think Mike made an excellent point, Steve, with your OI on top of the blindness, because of course the blindness made your OI even more dangerous, not being able to see, to avoid stumbles and falls as much. It took a lot of courage just to push yourself through childhood and to do so much as an adult, and it's an honor to know you, Steve.
Thanks very much, Jen. I don't know what to say for that. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to know all you people as well. And I'll keep teasing you all, so, you know, you just watch out. The King of England is on your case. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, well, you know, in my mind's eye, I can think of the school that I went to, and that was the school where you should have been originally. You know, bright people. We had a couple of people that were even emotionally upset and this, that, and the other, but I can think of all of the stairs. You know, the main building was there from 1862 or 83, right after the Civil War is when they built that main building. And there were cast iron stairways and everything. back then. Then I went there, you know, beginning in 1960, and all sorts of, you know, outbuildings had been built, but stairs everywhere. A catastrophe for someone like you, but you made it through anyway. Hats off, my man.
Bill
Coyne. Yeah, I would agree with that, and I would also say, Jennifer, it's a great honour to have known Steve, but I'd also like to add that it's still a great honour to know Steve, and it's also a great honour to know Sue, and I hope I shall know him for many more years to come.
Steve, I'm honoured to call you my friend.
Thank you very much, Liz. It's an honour to be your friend as well.
Well, Jennifer, you did a great job. Steve, you did a wonderful job. It was just really neat. And I think that sculpturing thing is so interesting. I'd love to see some of that stuff because I used to love to play with clay and stuff when I was a little kid, and I never even thought about getting into anything like that.
Yeah, Jen, that was a great interview. I'm glad you're doing your pre-interview. You pulled some of this stuff out because that's one of the things that blind people do so well. You know, when I was growing up in school, you know, one of the really really main things that they stressed back then. Yeah, of course I'm dating myself, but that's been over 35 years ago, almost 40 years ago. They did a lot of work with their hands. There's sculpturing in the arts, and there was mat weaving and caning chairs. I don't know if you guys had cane chairs over there, but we used to have caning over here. That was one of the big things they did. And then making doormats out of youth car tires, strung on wires and so forth. I mean, blind people work well with their hands. That's all there is to it.
That's true, Mike. Well, again, Becky couldn't be with us today, and I want to invite everyone to join us again next week at 1:30 Eastern when Country Music Bar will be interviewing Peg Gaines from Ohio. So we'll have a songbird interviewing another beautiful songbird. Again, thanks, Dennis, and everyone for coming today.